Autumn Shadows in August by Robert W. Norris. Copyright 2006, Robert W. Norris. Read by Robert W. Norris. If you would like to order a PDF download or trade paperback copy, go to www.lulu.com/Robert Norris. Autumn Shadows in August is also available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other online bookstores. Chapter 8. We were on the train from Basel to Milan. Cowardy was seated across from me reading a book. Fields of corn flanked us on both sides. Farther ahead, green hills rolled into the distant Alps. I stared at the picture of Thomas that Undine had given me. Cowardy looked up from her book and said, "Are you thinking about Thomas?" "Yes," I sighed. "It's really sad how he spent his final years. The memories I have of him are so different from how he died. I feel sorry for Undine and her children. It's all so different from how I imagined it would be. I had no idea he'd had to go to jail 3 times for a total of 7 years. He was so full of idealism, energy, and a zest for life when I knew him. I just can't imagine him as an angry man strung out on heroin, cocaine, and whiskey. It must have been hell on Undine." Cowardy reached over and touched me. "Try to think of the positive, honey-chan. There was something at work here. I've probably said this 100 times, but it seems that Thomas was pulling us. You really surprised me before this trip when you said suddenly, 'Let's go to Europe.' That wasn't like you. I think Thomas's spirit was calling to you, and it was important for you to see Undine. You did a wonderful thing for her. You gave her a chance yesterday to go back beyond the bad times and remember the good times she had with Thomas. She was able to smile, laugh, tell stories, remember her youth, and relive the good days. She had a beautiful laugh and smile. Her eyes were very bright when she looked at you." "Yeah, I guess you're right. There was just so much for both of us to tell and so little time to do it." "Do you remember what she said about his time in jail? She said he found a quiet place for his soul there. He wrote her 60-page letters, and she waited every week for his beautiful letters. Maybe it was better for him then to be in jail, because when he was out, he was trying to make money and couldn't, and the anger against society began again." We were quiet for a while. Scattered images and random thoughts about Thomas continued to fill my head as the train wheels clattered on the tracks. The story Undine told of their passing through the Khyber Pass and nearly being assaulted for taking pictures came to me. Undine had laughed when telling the story, saying she still had the pictures, and it seemed that she was proud of his fearlessness, his stubbornness, his lust for adventure, even his recklessness. I remembered my own bus journey through the Khyber Pass and thought of the plump Pakistani who befriended me on the bus. There had been an uprising against the Bhutto regime for supposedly rigging recent elections. There were soldiers everywhere, and the people had to be off the streets at night. The Pakistani was the owner of a small motel and insisted I stay with him and his wife once we got to Lahore. I did, and while he provided me with a simple, nutritious meal and stories of Lahore's history, muffled sounds of gunshots came from the streets. It seemed that all through that journey, complete strangers had watched over me and given me refuge from danger. Cowardy spoke again. "Undine is really a strong and beautiful woman, don't you think?" "Yes, I do." "Do you remember what she said when I told her I thought she was a powerful woman?" "Yeah, she said that some people were afraid of her because of her size, but she just wants to put her head on someone's shoulder and rest it there most of the time." "Doesn't it seem to you that the gentlest people are often the most powerful looking?" I smiled and said, "And sometimes the most powerful are the smallest, like you." We laughed together and I felt better. Cowardy had a knack for snapping me out of foul moods. I was probably dwelling too much on trying to figure out why Thomas had died just as we were about to arrive in Lorac. There had to be a reason for the strength of the call to see him and his death just before arriving. I wanted badly to know and to put things together as to what it all had to do with my life now. It was just too mysterious and confusing. Why now? What did it portend for the future? What had been the connection between Thomas and me? I thought again of Malcolm Lowry and Juan Fernando. Lowry had turned Juan Fernando's death into something symbolically positive. Lowry had peppered the manuscript of Dark as the Grave Wherein My Friend Is Laid with Juan Fernando quotes like, "Are you making tragedies?" and "Throw away your mind." And indeed, now Thomas rather than I was the true maker of tragedies. Like Juan Fernando, Thomas had died from drinking too much, although in Juan Fernando's case it was from too much mezcal. In a sense, both had gone loco crazy. I knew I was stretching things too far, but the more my mind dwelled on it, the more it was impossible to escape the conviction that there was tremendous meaning in all the coincidences contained both in this trip and in Lowry's return trip to Mexico. Because, like Juan Fernando to Lowry, Thomas was to me the symbol of everything connected to the past. Lowry had written about Juan Fernando that no one could be more alive and life-giving in spite of all than he was. And so Thomas was to me now. I had felt something deep like the converging of the past, present, and future into one when Undine drove us to the top of the hill. I thought again about the night on the hill when Thomas had explained all his ideals about setting up communities for like-minded international groups to live in and exchange every few years, and talked about the importance of family and friends and love, and also told me everything he'd known about the politics, histories, and cultures of Iran and Afghanistan. Yes, that hill had remained afterward in my mind a symbol of the past, a place where my own Sermon on the Mount had been delivered by the Maker of Tragedies, who had passed on to me some important guideposts to the rest of my life that, if you stretched it far enough, had guided me to Kaori, who had been passed the torch and taken care of me these last 15 years. Perhaps it was best Thomas had died before we had a chance to meet and talk again. I might have been disappointed had he lived instead and presented himself as an embittered old man filled with frustration, anger, hatred, and darkness. We had certainly thrown away our minds that special night on top of the hill, and I'd never forget it. A new sadness gripped me. "I'm glad we took the train instead of a plane," Cowardy said. I looked out the window to see we were now climbing into the Alps. Long shadows ran down the sides of jagged mountains to a placid lake that was a deep green and reflected perfectly the surrounding scenery. Farmhouses speckled the lower portions along the lake. The colors were subdued and blended well with the landscape. White clouds perched on top of the higher peaks. "It is truly beautiful, isn't it?" I said. "You know, I've seen more paintings in the last week than I've seen in all my life. I'm so glad I got to see the Van Gogh Museum, the Rembrandt Museum, and all the small museums in Basel. I think I'm learning more and more about color and nuance."
"In what way?"
"Well, for example, if I were trying to paint the trees and this scenery here, I'd definitely have to add streaks of white," Cowardy said, a marked look of satisfaction on her face.
"I'm glad to hear that you're learning, absorbing, and feeling things. I'd hoped this trip might do something like that for you."
"Oh, yes, honey-chan." Cowardy reached over and held my right hand with both of her hands. "This is a wonderful trip. I'm so glad we're here, right now at this moment. You know how I love mountains, and I'm really looking forward to everything in Florence, especially Florence."
"Me too. Like I told you, Florence has some special memories for me, very different from the memories of the journey that brought Thomas and me together."
"How different?" Cowardy rubbed my arm and looked directly at me.
"Well, I was 22 years old and at the beginning of that first journey to Europe. Peggy, the American art student I met in Paris, is the one who mapped out an itinerary for me to follow, and she strongly recommended Florence because it was the birthplace of the Renaissance and has hundreds of years of art history. I spent quite a bit of time just wandering the streets and walking through the different galleries. I was in complete awe of the works I saw, especially Michelangelo's David. It was really in Florence that the idea first hit me that I, too, might be able to create something of lasting value, express myself in some art form. I didn't know at the time that writing would become my means of expression, but somehow I was soaking in the atmosphere and feeling that art could help me find my way out of the confusion of my life. I was older and more experienced, more sure of myself on my second journey when I met Thomas. Maybe by the time I met him, I had more faith in the winds of fate."
"Maybe my life will change too when we get to Florence," Cowardy smiled broadly.
"You never know, it just might. Anyway, more than any other place on this trip, Florence is the one spot I wanted to show you. It won't be long now." We were now high up in the mountains, and the view of the gorge below was spectacular. Our conversation stopped except for exclamations of "Ooh!" and "Ah!" when we saw a beautiful waterfall, a massive bridge spanning the gorge, or a particularly large boulder rising out of the river far below. Then we passed through a series of tunnels interrupted by short open stretches. We felt we were getting closer to Italy as the names of the small villages we passed through changed from German-sounding and consonant-dominated names like Amsteg-Selinan, Wassen, and Goschenen to Italian-sounding and vowel-ending names like Faido, Lavorgo, Poligio, and Bellinzona. The slate rooftops of the houses we passed became more colorful, pink, blue, and orange. Finally, we arrived at the Swiss-Italian border. My gut tightened when I saw four border policemen and a German shepherd dog board the coach next to ours. We heard the sounds of passengers moving about, baggage being pulled down from upper shelves, and the policemen speaking roughly in Italian. Cowardy looked at me and asked anxiously, "What's going on?" "They're checking for drugs." One of the policemen entered our coach and walked down the center aisle, motioning for people to have their bags ready for inspection. Cowardy and I pulled our backpacks down from the storage shelf above the seats and put them on the seats next to us. A moment later, another policeman leading the dog on a leash entered the coach. The dog was in a high state of excitement. The policeman roughly patted the bags of the passengers ahead of us while the dog pulled at the leash and sniffed the bags. They came to us. Cowardy's bags were ignored, but the dog lingered over my bag for an extended moment. My heart stopped. The dog handler stared at me, probably checking for signs of panic on my face, then moved on. A bead of sweat slid down my ear. I exhaled slowly and looked over at Cowardy, whose eyes were wide as she watched the procession continue down the aisle. "My God, I can't believe this," she said excitedly. "It's just like in the movie Julia, when Lillian Hellman was at the French-German border with the dogs and everything. This is some kind of experience for me. I've got to take a picture of this." "Are you crazy?" I whispered as urgently as I could. "I don't think you should." She didn't hear me and pulled the camera out of her bag just as the dog began barking and sniffing heatedly several seats down from us. She snapped a picture, then started to stand to try to take a better picture. I tugged her shirt and said forcefully, "Don't, Cowardy, it might be illegal." "Oh, sorry." She hurriedly put the camera back in her bag. A group of policemen was now gathered at the rear of our coach and rummaging through the backpacks of some young travelers. Two of the travelers, a young man and woman, both around 19 or 20 years old, were taken off the train, backpacks in tow. They put up no resistance and looked forlorn. The dog and two of the policemen continued on to the next coach. 10 minutes later, the train slowly pulled out of the station. Two policemen and the two backpackers, their faces downcast, were still standing on the platform. I felt a deep sorrow for them. "That was incredible," Cowardy said. "I've never experienced anything like that. This is a good experience for me." "Not so good, I think. Those poor kids were probably just college kids on vacation trying to bring back a little pot from Amsterdam, and now their futures are possibly ruined. I'll bet they're shitting their pants right now."
"What do you think will happen to them?"
"I have no idea, but I'm sure being busted for any kind of drug in Italy is no petty thing. Amsterdam may be liberal, but the rest of Europe doesn't take a kind view of possession. There'll probably be some jail time."
"It feels like we're in some kind of international espionage movie."
"I can assure you this was no movie."
"Were you nervous?"
"You bet I was. I was worried there for a moment that I might have some pot residue in my bag."
"But you threw away the rest of your marijuana in Amsterdam."
"I know," I said. "Anyway, I feel sorry for those kids. I don't imagine jail in Italy would be a whole lot of fun." The border scene got me thinking back to my own jail experiences. I had been about the same age as the backpackers. The day of my court-martial returned, the sentencing by the judge, the feel of handcuffs placed around my wrists, the guards shoving me into a concrete cubicle, the sound of the door slamming behind me and the guard turning the key in the lock. In all my life, the future had never appeared as bleak and hopeless as in that solitary moment. Border crossings, Jesus, what nerve-wracking experiences! In the dozens of borders I had crossed in my journeys, There had been moments of anxiety, even fear and paranoia, but I had been lucky and passed through every border successfully. Undine's stories of Thomas hit me again, especially the one about his using Steve Sugar's American passport to get out of Afghanistan and back to Germany after Undine had given birth to their first child. He had been lucky too, at least in that instance. My mind started playing the what-if game. What if the border police had nabbed me and taken me away from Cowardy? In my weakened condition, would the prison experience and the certainty of the ruination of our future had been the end of me? How dark and Dostoevskian would the remainder of my life have become? Would I have died an ignominious death in prison? Would Cowardy have been able to carry on without me? How badly would the shame of my actions have affected her life, and how badly would she have been ostracized in Japan as the wife of a respectable university professor turned drug addict? In that sense, wasn't the entire life I had worked so hard to create in Japan nothing more than a sham? Wasn't half of my life a cover-up anyway? Oh boy, here we were going again, the long-delayed result of the thought processes the military had tried to inculcate into my brain 30 years before. Boy, if you continue on the path you're pursuing, you'll be marked as a coward, a traitor, a worthless piece of shit in the greatest country in the world, and the stigma you carry for the rest of your life will prevent you from ever getting a decent job and mark you as a parasitic worm in a society that will shun you, spit on you, kick you continuously in the balls as you crawl from place to place until finding your grave at the end. There was that word grave again, which brought back the title, Dark is the Grave Wherein My Friend is Laid, and both the connection with Thomas, now in the grave, and Malcolm Lowry. Hadn't Lowry spent the entirety of his life in such paranoid thinking? What must it have been like for him in his humiliations at the hands of the Mexican immigration authorities, particularly the sinister Inspector Fatty, who accompanied Lowry and his wife Marjorie on the train from Mexico City to the U.S. border and forced Lowry at gunpoint to sign a confession to breaking Mexican laws before Lowry was deported the next day. Surely Lowry had thought several times in his life that he would die homeless, forgotten, and buried in a foreign land. Lowry had at one point written to Juan Fernando asking why the Mexican authorities prosecuted a man who only wanted to write poetry. He believed it was another example of his fate continually casting him into a dark pit. Lowry's suffering endured at that time. Words saved him, and writing was, more than any other time of his life, his form of therapy, the thing that enabled him to keep a grip on his sanity. Which was also true of me, at least in my 20s, when the effect of the prison psychiatrists was such that doubts and paranoias about my own existence had caused me to feel that, like Lowry, my own life had become a wasted voyage. Writing had, to a large extent, saved me from myself. It was a pity, too, that Thomas hadn't found the same outlet, the same release outside prison. Cowardy had picked up on Undine's story concerning the respite writing had given Thomas, those 60-page letters, but it was the return to society after prison that concerned me. I myself had had more difficulty there than during the actual prison experience itself. Undine had said that Thomas often thought of writing a book about his adventures in Afghanistan and other parts of the world, his smuggling experiences, his living for short periods of time with some of the nomads in the desert, his prison days. But he had never followed up on the idea, and instead turned to whiskey and hard drugs, not just hallucinogens and hashish, to escape from the paranoias, darknesses, and demons associated with that thinking process that, once started, will not release you. Rather, you have to release it, control it, let it out piece by piece. I thank the Lord I was able to find it. Poor Thomas. Could it be that Lowry's guiding angels, the virgin for those that have nobody with, and his saint of dangerous and desperate causes, had also guided me to the therapy of writing and the means to keep a grip on my own sanity? I wondered. Whether or not Lowry's angels had led me there, the writing had indeed saved my ass. Ha! The great pacifist here who killed thousands on paper in order to let them and him live in real life. For a moment I believed that I was on the track of an important truth that I had somehow overlooked and yet was somehow bound up with a fundamental law of human destiny. I felt a little excited, as if I could share these thoughts with Cowardy, who was the only one capable of understanding, but the excitement dissipated with this thought. How on earth can you communicate the extraordinary drama of your interpretation of your life, your thought process, your imaginings of Thomas, Malcolm Lowry, and yourself to anyone other than yourself? Haven't the doors opened by and the revelations gained in your LSD and mushroom trips taught you anything? There's no need to communicate these thoughts to others. Why bother? One thing was for sure. I couldn't shake the feeling that Thomas's death, coming after those other bad omens, and now this drug bust at the border, was not the end of something, but a stark warning that something even more terrible was about to happen to Cowardy and me. The train was nearing Milan. Cowardy was engrossed in a book about Florence. She took notice of the train slowing down, closed her book, and said, "What have you been thinking about?" "Nothing important, really,"